All right, before we get going too deep into hats, I have to tell you one thing. I want to tell you one thing, which is that every couple of weeks we do a thing called Radio for the Deaf. This is, in fact, it is an attempt to create a form of radio which can be experienced and enjoyed by the deaf community. So we have two wonderful interpreters here in the studio with me. They are interpreting everything I say and everything the guests say into American Sign Language. That is available on Facebook Live on the Colin McEnroe Show page on Facebook. So Colin McEnroe Show on Facebook, you'll see a video feed of everything that we're going to do today. And it would be great if you know anybody in the deaf community anywhere in America who might be interested in a radio show about hats. That's what we're about to do today. I mean, that may be a fairly small subset of humankind. Someone who's deaf wants to experience a radio show and is really interested in hats. Even if you're not really interested in hats, though, I think we can get you interested in hats. I'm betting on us. So let me talk a little bit about that before we bring the guests aboard. You know, so my favorite hat scene. Well, there's so many great hat scenes, obviously, and the Marx Brothers could do amazing things with hats. The hat scene that sticks in my mind is an odd one. It's from the movie Deliverance. It's before they get out into the woods. They stop at a really, really old-looking gas station with those really, you know, 1940s, 1950s-looking gas pumps. And it's actually the scene where the famous duel between the guitar and the banjo happens. But before that musical interlude takes place, Ned Beatty, who plays the character of Bobby, is talking to kind of like a country-looking guy who's hanging around at the gas station. Maybe he works there. Maybe he doesn't. He's got kind of a, you know, I don't know. He's got a hat. He's wearing a hat. It's kind of pulled down towards his ears. And Bobby looks at him and says, "Mister, I love the way you wear that hat." And the man takes off his hat and examines it very carefully and puts it back on his head and looks at Bobby and says, "You don't know nothing." And I think there are a lot of lessons there, particularly if you remember what happened to Bobby eventually. But first of all, you know, hats are a very personal thing, and you shouldn't be condescending about somebody's hat. The hat is the item of clothing we wear the closest to the face, unless you count eyeglasses as some kind of clothing. It's the one kind of clothing that I can think of that we can take on and off very easily, or take off and put back on, I guess I should say, very easily. As a result, it winds up having a lot of codes bred into it. So we want to talk about all that. We've got a lot of great guests here. We're going to begin with Claire Hughes, independent scholar and author of several fashion-related books, including Dressed in Fiction and her most recent, Hats. So Claire Hughes, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Maybe we could just begin by saying humankind, I guess, has worn hats since there's been a humankind. I mean, when they find somebody preserved in a bog from, you know, thousands of years BC or Atsi, you know, frozen in ice, he's usually wearing a hat. It's probably, though, a pretty utilitarian hat, right? I assume the first reason we wore hats was to keep our head warm.
Yes, it's protective against sun and wind and rain. I think it very quickly becomes ornamental and important and symbolic very, very quickly.
Like how quickly?
There's a very strange hat. You could almost call it headgear. It goes back a couple of thousand years. It's a long gold cone. It's very, very tall. It's about 2 meters tall. It was worn in Northern Europe. It was clearly worn by the most important person in that group. They have been found by archaeologists. So, if you think of, for example, helmets in animal form, in fact, they're still around. Those strange fur busbies that often you get guardsmen wearing, they go way back. To warriors who would wear the heads of animals that they had killed in order to terrify the enemy. So it's more than protective. It's very, very quickly it becomes powerful, symbolic, important.
I do think that there we go through periods in various societies where hats represent, I would assume, a pretty close demarcation of either your class, your religious affiliation, your rank somehow or other. I'm thinking in particular of I just rewatched the television adaptation of Wolf Hall. So here we are in the 16th century, and of course Henry VIII's got these hats that we know from his portraiture, and many of the people who are courtiers who surround him. Well, Thomas Cromwell and Thomas More, the most famous portrait of Thomas Cromwell, he's wearing one of those kind of trapezoidal hats that actually have these things that come down over the ears. On the other hand, there's a whole bunch of people walking around in what are sort of caps, these kind of loose-fitting, angled, silk, brimless caps. I'm assuming if I knew more about that world, I would be able to attach specific meanings to all those hats. Would that be correct?
Yes, well, the caps are have probably got an ecclesiastical connection. Mm-hmm. But the Henry VIII himself would have been wearing a fine, probably a beaver felt hat, which would have had jewels in it, would have been braided. The more jewels, the more braid, the more important. So the beaver hat, which actually takes us to North America,
sure.
is the status hat. It goes right back to the 16th century at least, and say for 300 years, that hat was the key male hat. It has to be said that the story of hats divides very clearly into male and female.
Right. So when we talk about the beaver hat, I know that we're talking about a hat that involves the pelt of the beaver, but what's the shape of that hat? What does it look like?
Oh, well, it's all kinds of shapes. Mm-hmm. If you saw Henry VIII's one, it's fairly small and it's turned up at the front. It's probably the crown will be concealed by the front, which will be covered in braid and jewels. But if you get into the 17th century, that's really perhaps the most gorgeous time for that hat. It's what we call the cavalier hat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually black, although it can be gray, even white. And it's broad-brimmed and fairly low-crowned, and it will be plumed. It's very important that plumes become very important for that hat. That goes on really up until the end of the 17th century. And it's the Puritans who take that hat, take off all the braid, mm-hmm. all the plumes, and they wear it as a symbol of protest, a symbol of their religion. And then it actually gets transferred over to the United States. And the first congressmen will wear it, those tall black beaver hats.
Right. So you've got, Puritan rejection of bejewelment and adornment. I guess we should say that these hat trends are good for milliners and hatters and people who make hats. They're often very bad for animals, right? I mean, such a reliance on the beaver for all kinds of hat styles and the reliance on plumes. I know plume hunting has driven species of birds to the brink of extinction, including the snowy egret, I think, at
yes,
one point.
Yes.
So talk about that. Talk about like what happens to animals.
Well, I wanted to give a talk about something I call bad hats. And I took the beaver and then the ostrich hat, the ostrich feathered hat. And I mean, the story of the beaver is terrible. By 1600, hatters had wiped out the European beaver. There just were none left in Europe. Fortunately, although bad luck for beavers, there was North America just full of beavers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the Dutch, the French, and the British who turned their attention to North America, and they went over there and they used the tribal hunters, the Native American hunters, to hunt the beaver, which actually destroyed the tribal economies, the tribal agriculture, because the huntsmen were away for most of the year. And fortunately, the silk top hat came in just in time to save the beaver in North America. So they survived. But it's really a terrible story. I mean, the destruction of the Native American tribes was really because of the hunt for the beaver pelt.
Right. And you have something that becomes kind of valuable in a way that exceeds any recognizable normal value you could attach to it. So you've got what? You've got even Native American peoples fighting one another over beaver.
Actually, they're fighting each other for trading rights. And then, of course, the Dutch, the French, and the British are competing with one another. They exchange arms. They exchange alcohol for the pelts, which is not doing anybody any good. Mm-hmm. And it's an ugly thing. In fact, eventually, it's the British who dominate. They take the Dutch go first, then the French. But the British control of the fur trade is quite short lived, up until 1776. And then you've got the American Fur Company that takes over with the John Jacob Astor, who is and still is the richest man in the world. Mm. And it's all down to the beaver. You could say that beaver fur was the most valuable single item of European trade from 1500 to 1800.
All right, so you've got we might as well, since we've now done in the beaver or pretty close to having done in the beaver, we might want to look over on the bird side where there's a similar thing going on, right? God save the bird whose plume becomes popular.
Yeah. Yes, then we switch because the beaver hats definitely mainly for men, although women do actually they borrow those hats, but you're now in around 1900. The hat, the woman's hat, suddenly explodes. They are the biggest hats you have ever seen. They're placed not down on the head, but on top of it. So you've got these big hairstyles with this great platform of, it's usually straw, and they cover these in flowers, feathers. And the most costly feathers are the egrets, you know, the ones you mentioned. And in order to get egret feathers, you have to kill the egret. Mm-hmm. Ostriches were a little different. First of all, the ostriches were hunted in North Africa. But then what you got was ostrich farms in South Africa. And then they become a lot cheaper. But, of course, the hats then, there's a lot more of them. And so ostriches are become valuable. And there is an amazing hat. It's an iconic hat. It's called the Merry Widow hat, if you've come across it. It was around about 1907. There was a musical called The Merry Widow. Mm-hmm. And it started in Vienna. It came to London. When it came to London, the producer put all his money on an unknown beautiful actress called Lily Elsie. And he gave her a makeover, and a famous designer, milliner called Lucille, made her a hat. It was black with black egret feathers and pink roses. And when she walked onto the stage in this hat, the show stopped. It was a sensation. Then they took the show to the States in 1908, and there it was even more sensational. The producer offered a hat to every lady who had bought a ticket with a coupon. And there was a riot at the first night when ladies stormed onto the stage demanding hats. that was the perhaps you might say, the zenith of the ostrich hat. And then suddenly, around 1914, the beginning of the First World War, it just looked wrong. It was too elaborate. And of course, you have the Audubon Society campaigning against the awful depredation of bird life. And then suddenly, no more feathers. Mm. And so what do you do with all those poor ostriches in South Africa? they just opened the gates and let them out. Mm. So it was bad for ostriches, too.
When we talk about all this, and we talk about, you know, the incredible value of the beaver to a point that it caused exploration of the New World by the Old World. It disrupted Native American society. It really becomes this pinnacle of trade. Now we're talking about these feathers, and it's all for hats. And I think for maybe people now who live in a society where hats are not really paramount the way they once were. That's hard to picture. But for hundreds and hundreds of years, the hat, well, I mean, in in Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, a milliner, so probably someone with a bit of a prejudice, says it is the hat that matters most. But there was some real truth attaching itself to that statement, right?
Absolutely. Yes. And really up until the 1960s, you did not go out without a hat. That was men and women. It was just not done. And certainly for men, it could be an insult. If you turned up at a business meeting without a hat, it was insulting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a novel, late 19th century, where a rather poor clerk is sent off by his employer to a business meeting, and he puts his head out of the train window, unfortunately, and loses his hat.
Mm.
And he knows he can't go to a business meeting without a hat. So at the first station, he buys another hat with his employer's money, assuming that it'd be okay, but it isn't. The employer sacks him, and that leads to his suicide. This importance of wearing a hat, the question of respect, self-respect, respect for your superiors, and your status, is all tied up in this one item, the hat, especially for men.
We should talk a little bit more about that part of it, the notion of manners, the notion of etiquette, because the hat is something that we can, as I said before, take off and put back on much more easily than we can do with any other item of clothing. It's a natural for various social codes. So at some point, as you say, it becomes a way of dishonoring an exchange if you're not wearing a hat during whatever social or business exchange that is. But then there's this whole business of taking the hat off, doffing the hat. I know there's at least one instance where Churchill leaves his hat on, right, when his French counterpart has taken his hat off.
I think he's meeting. I think he's meeting a Russian official, and the Russian takes his hat off, and Churchill keeps his on. He might have done that again with the French, but I think it would have been a bit more difficult with the French. The French are very, very strict on etiquette. The French formality and etiquette is very important for them. But yes, the taking off of the hat, and it's interesting, there are etiquette books which tell you just exactly how much you should take the hat off. If you meet a friend in the street and he's your equal, you just need to tip the hat slightly and nod. You don't need to do anything very much. If you meet your social inferior, this is an American etiquette book.
Yes.
You don't have to take your hat off. You just exchange some kind words and move on. And if you meet a friend with a lady, you take your hat right off and you make a bow which includes both the lady and your friend. And you stop and you bow. So there's a kind of range of things that you may or may not do with your hat when you take it off.
So, yes, and there's that notion of these situations where you should remove your hat. There are buildings now when you enter a church, a man is typically expected to remove his hat, probably also in a restaurant. You wouldn't expect a mafia-connected master criminal to be a person who could really advise you about hat etiquette. But here we have Tony Soprano getting upset in a restaurant when another man keeps his hat on.
Look at this. It's Facchino over here. We're at a cap in a nice restaurant like this.
That burns my ass. Where you going?
Take your hat off.
Excuse me?
They don't sell hot dogs here. They took the bleachers out 2 years ago.
It's my hat. I'll wear it where I want.
So there, Claire, we kind of have the opposite of where we started. It's insulting to keep your hat on.
Yes, restaurants are quite tricky. People didn't go to restaurants really to the end of the 19th century. It was very difficult to decide whether that was a private space or a public space. And there are some outdoor cafes, you keep it on.
Right.
So you've got pictures of, let's say, the French Impressionists in an outdoor cafe, and they've got their hats on. But if you go inside, then you've got an indoor space, and then a man should take his hat off. The ladies can keep them on. The tricky places were like, for example, hotels Whereabouts in a hotel do you keep your hat on? Where do you take it off? You keep it on if you're on the staircase, but if you go into the dining room or a lounge, you take it off. There are all sorts of tricky areas like art galleries, museums. What do you do with your hat? The interesting one is when you go to the theatre or the opera in the 19th century, and a man had to wear a top hat to go to the opera. There was no question about that. So what does he do when he gets into the opera? He can't sit there with this huge hat on. So a Frenchman called Monsieur Gibus invented this very smart top hat, which with a flick of the wrist and a nice sort of clacking noise, it went absolutely flat. Mm. And you could stick it underneath your seat, which solved the problem of what to do with your hat in the theatre.
All right. So despite the widespread popularity of hats from the 17th to the 20th centuries, there tended to be just a few real epicenters of hat making. One of them was Danbury, Connecticut, which is still known as the Hat City, although it's known mainly symbolically. We have a guest coming on here from Danbury. But before we get to that, Claire, since you've kind of looked over the entire world of hat making, what can you tell us about the fact that Danbury does occupy this very special place in the world of making hats?
Well, I imagine it's a little bit like the English town of Stockport. That's how I see it. It's probably near water. It's near a river. Mm-hmm. It will have access to a city not too far away. It will have, in Stockport, they have access to the coal fields. I would imagine maybe in Danbury it's more like fuel from wood. But you need the heat and you need water and you need transport to a nearby town or city. And I imagine that Danbury is a little like that.
Well, let's find out. Let's find out from Bridget Gerton, a Danbury city historian and executive director of the Danbury Museum and Historical Society. Bridget, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on today.
And what can you tell us about this? How is it that Danbury in particular, of all places, comes to have this industry and a reputation to go along with it?
We got lucky. Danbury had the raw ingredients to make hatting a success. As Claire was mentioning, Danbury was similar to Stockport in that we had access to water, the Still River, which you need. You need a copious amount of water when you're making men's fur felt hats. We had a ready labor pool, which we continually expanded. So each major wave of immigration to come to the United States, a portion of that immigrant wave ended up coming to Danbury. So we were constantly increasing our labor pool. And we also had ready access to fuel. We did use wood in the beginning, but when we got a train station here in 1851, we started bringing in the coal. And, of course, that made the process go quicker. And then we also were able to transport our goods very easily. So we could bring our goods down by wagon, by Teamster, before we got the train. But the goods that we sold in places like Bridgeport or New York City were very expensive to transport down. But once we got a railroad station in town, we could load up those cars with all of our awesome Danbury hats. Well, then the business really expanded.
One thing I was going to ask both of you, about this, but Bridget, I'll talk to you about this. So Lewis Carroll gives us the Mad Hatter. We have the expression mad as a hatter. I've always understood this to have something to do with the mercury involved or some mercury compound made in used in making hats. I don't know. Does Danbury have a Mad Hatter tradition?
Yes, we do. Unfortunately, we in the Danbury area, and I include Danbury and Bethel and Norwalk, which also had many hat factories as well. We used the solution of mercury nitrate in what we commonly call the carroting part of the process. And this helped separate the fur. It helped the process turning the fur into felt go a little faster. And what's important to know is that though it helped our hatting industry, it was environmentally disastrous on both the human side and the natural side. So as we use this material, the mercury, it affected the workers, eventually affected the people who were wearing our hats, and it definitely negatively affected our environment. We poured excess chemicals and materials into the Still River, and this was problematic. It was a compound problem that happened. year after year, decade after decade, until we self-policed, kind of got ahead of the curve on how to use mercury in the industry. And then the federal government, of course, had all kinds of rules and regulations in the 1880s, 1890s, and 1920s, again in the 1940s, to kind of protect the communities at large from the use of mercury within the hatting industry and as well as other industries.
Claire Hughes, we yes. now know that notion of the Mad Hatter, yes. that mercury compound did produce a kind of symptom, right?
Oh, terrible. Yes. Certainly it was with the French and the British, both throughout the 18th and the 19th centuries were worried about this because when they were processing the felt, they had to dunk the fur, the material in a mixture of mercury salts, nitric acids, and urine. And they had to put in and out and in and out of this filthy mixture. I think recently they've decided it wasn't so much the mercury that was coming through the skin. It was actually when they started to heat the felt, when they were shaping the hats on the hat molds, and it was the fumes that they were inhaling that was actually causing these. First of all, these tremors. You would start with very strange behavioral situations where they would suddenly get hysterical and angry, and then you got tremors, and then you got madness, and then you got death. And both French and the British were aware, the hat unions were aware of this, but in fact they weren't able to stop it until 1912.
So, Bridget, now, if a person drives into Danbury in 2018, there's no hat factory left, I assume. What is there? What can we see to remind us of this industry in Danbury?
Well, we can point to some of the buildings which have been adaptively reused for other business. We have a beautiful sculptural piece that the City of Danbury and locally Union Savings Bank funded a couple of years ago. And it's called The Hatter, and he sits in front of City Hall to remind us of our past and remind us of the strength of the Danbury community. And we also have the John Dodd Hat Shop at the Danbury Museum, where we talk about our hatting history and explore hat making from small hat shop to large hat factory.
Well, Bridget Girton, first of all, thank you so much for talking to us. We wouldn't dream of doing a show about hats without talking about Danbury. We're going to take a little break. Bridget Girton, by the way, Danbury City Historian and Executive Director of the Danbury Museum and Historical Society. We're going to be back with more of Claire Hughes. We'll take a little break here, and obviously we'll be back with more about hats.
We have found the witch, might we burn, huh? Burn her!
How do you know she is a witch?
She looks like one!
Yes, she does!
Bring her forward.
I'm not a witch, I'm not a witch!
But you are dressed as one.
They dressed me up like this.
Well, we did do the nose.
The nose?
And the hat. But she is a witch!
So that's how you know who somebody is, apparently. Of course, that's Monty Python and the Holy Grail because of the hat. We're talking about hats right now. We've been talking about their different functions, their roles, their role particularly of as signifiers of various members. Well, actually, Claire Hughes, while we're on the subject of Monty Python, Claire Hughes, by the way, independent scholar and author of several fashion-related books, including Dressed in Fiction and her most recent Hats. I feel as though the hat that I associate most with Monty Python and all kinds of other cultural expressions is the bowler. You know, every time I see someone wearing a bowler hat in Monty Python, that person I know is supposed to be boring, works probably somewhere in the financial sector. Those are the two main things. But you think of bowlers in the way Magritte used them and the way Charlie Chaplin used them and the fact that they were, I think, probably more prevalent in the Old West of this country than the Stetson or anything we might identify as a cowboy hat. Bowlers can mean all kinds of different things, but what do they mean specifically? Like when Monty Python uses them, are they pointing to a particular group in Britain?
Well, yes, but by the time he's wearing them, it's become a joke.
Yeah.
You know, is the bowler. Think in America you call them the Derby.
Yeah.
It's associated with London businessmen. But by the time you get to Monty Python, which is 1970s, you've got that whole late 60s counterculture.
Right.
And the businessman, the capitalist, becomes dull and conventional. And what you got in Britain at the time was, on the media, was a whole satirical movement, which was really sending up the previous generation associated with the Second World War and just in the 1950s, which was so conventional. So Monty Python is actually mocking the bowler. Actually, the bowler has been used as a funny hat for a long time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've got Charlie Chaplin. But the interesting thing about Charlie Chaplin is that he uses it like a clown. But it's terribly important that Charlie Chaplin never, ever loses hold of that hat. He always puts it back on. And it's his respect, his self-respect that he keeps clutching.
Right. That's a great point. So I think the other thing that's happening there with Monty Python, it's happening here in this country by the time of the 60s and 70s, is that hats become something that people used to wear but don't wear so much now. Here in America, we have often associated this with John F. Kennedy. There's at least this embedded notion, I don't know how true it is, that Kennedy killed the hat by not wearing one to his inauguration, something as important as that, no longer requiring a hat. But there's becomes a point where a hat is more of a signifier of something that ended in the 40s and 50s, right?
Yes. The Jack Kennedy thing. There's a wonderful book called Hatless Jack, mm-hmm. which is all about this. It's true that he didn't. He actually carried his hat. He didn't wear it, and he wore one the next day. But the thing about Kennedy was he was acutely aware of his image. He was really the first president to know how important it was how he looked. And he was handsome, and he had a wonderful shock of boyish hair, and he didn't look good in a hat. He didn't want to hide that. And so he really never wore one. But actually, you could say it started in the 30s. The decline of the hat was already beginning then. And Eisenhower refused to wear a top hat when he was inaugurated. He wore a hat, but it wasn't the top hat. Mm-hmm. So because Kennedy is an iconic figure, it's associated with him, but it was already beginning 20 years before it had already started the decline.
And of course, that's for men's hats. And so ironically and paradoxically, Jackie Kennedy with her pillbox hat and her other hat styles becomes, you know, something of a promoter of women's hats, probably in a way a little bit comparable to what Princess Diana did in England, too. Suddenly you've got somebody who looks great in hats. Maybe everybody else starts to think, well, I'll look good in a hat, too.
Yes. Well, Jackie Kennedy chose the pillbox, which is interesting because you know, she had a lot of hair and she had a very wide face. And you've got to be very careful what you do when you have a lot of hair and a wide face, what kind of hat you wear. You can't wear a big hat, otherwise you look like a, you know, lampshade or a mushroom. So she picked this little smart hat that actually had been very fashionable back in the 1850s and 60s. And it just sits on top of her hair. It doesn't hide anything. You can still see her gorgeous hair and her beautiful face. Nothing is hidden. So in a sense, she's bringing back a hat. But in another sense, she's also saying, I don't want the big gesture hat because I don't need it. And Princess Diana is an interesting example because she did, in a way, bring back certain kinds of hats. She was very young, and she was smart, right. And she picked for her milliners some very young men: the John Boyd, Philip Tracy, particularly Stephen Jones. And they chose hats for her, which were a little bit jaunty, and they were also slightly mannish. She She presumably wore a little tricorn.
Yes, I was actually Googling images of her hats today, and they are all of the things that you just said. And I do feel as though someone needs to do a hat consultation with Princesses Beatrice and Eugenie, who seem to be struggling a bit. We're going to have to stop there, Claire Hughes, independent scholar and author of most recently Hats. Very quickly, we're going to switch gears here. We have a lot of other hat stories to tell you, but very quickly, we want to talk about the kind of hat that you are most likely to see in America. It's not really a hat. It's a cap. And baseball caps or whatever, lids, whatever we're going to call them, have kind of taken over. Joining us now is Jessica Smetana, a video producer and writer for SB Nation. So, Jessica, an odd thing has happened with caps or lids or whatever we're going to call them, which is they've gone from being this kind of generic thing to a fashion item that expresses individuality. Tell us about that.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I think that... for sports fans, hats have become kind of a way to show your allegiance to a team or to a city and kind of demonstrate your identity in another additional way to your clothing. And it's kind of become a no-brainer to put on a hat with a logo on it and kind of be able to use that as a way to express, like, who you are and, like, what you're all about, you know?
And that kind of hat, I mean, it still is the case that somebody will, for promotional purposes, give you a cap, you know, a thing that we could sort of basically call a baseball-style cap and for nothing. But it's also become kind of a luxury item. I mean, how much could you wind up paying at a store like Lids for a really nice hat?
Well, I probably couldn't tell you, like, an exact price point, but they do make customized hats, and that is, like, one of the main things that they do. When I was in Minnesota for the Super Bowl, which is when I wrote this story about Lids, there was actually a Philadelphia Eagles player who had just been at the store that I was in who was getting a customized hat, and which is just kind of funny and speaks to, you know, going to a Lids where you see a bunch of hats that all look the same, but someone's still wanting their own thing and their own branding on one.
Right. And, of course, there's this person who now occupies the White House who also took that kind of cap and made it its own. It's kind of interesting that within the last, I don't know, 12 to 18 months, that kind of cap and the pussy hat have sort of gone to war, right? I mean, we think of America as a society that doesn't like hats, but really that's kind of how we've been battling things out.
Yeah, I actually almost see it as, like, pretty to be expected because you see people wearing hats. And like I said, like in the sports world, it's very much to demonstrate your identity with a team or whatever city you're from. But it makes sense that that would then extend itself into politics and be a way for people to express, you know, their political views or what they stand for in a more serious way.
Right. I mean, obviously, it's also a MAGA hat. It makes a lot of sense in a warm weather, Sun Belt, red state. And a pussy hat probably makes sense in a slightly more cold weather, blue state. That may be another reason that those hats are what they are. Obviously, sports has its own set of rules and iconography about hats, a hat trick in hockey. And people used to throw their hats on the ice. And there's an incredible – it's the kind of thing that Claire talked about. There's an incredible set of rules, or used to be in baseball, about tipping your cap. Ted Williams refused for many years to tip his cap to the Fenway fans because he was always having terrible fights with them. And they would beg him after he'd done something exemplary, hitting a grand slam or something, beg him to maybe step out of the dugout and tip his cap. I think towards the end of his career, he grudgingly sort of did it for them. All right, we're going to take a little break here. I want to remind you that we're doing the show in Radio for the Deaf. We have wonderful interpreters here making the show available in American Sign Language. To see that, you have to go to Facebook, and then you have to go to the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page. You can see a Facebook Live version of that. Thanks very much to the guests we've had so far. We've got more guests coming up ahead.
What kind of hat would you wear to a rally promoting solidarity and equality for cats? I'm just asking. Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish does not wear a hat. Fish never do. The part of Bill Curry was played by Ned Beatty. Thanks to Tucker Ives, Jonathan McPants, and everybody at Source Interpreting. And now, back to Colin.
If you've been ever been driving around downtown New Haven and driven by this place, you may have noticed what is really a landmark. It's called Delmonico Hatters. It is at 47 Elm Street. It is one of the last traditional hatters of this kind in the Northeast, maybe even in the whole country. We'll find out. Founded in 1908. Joining us right now is Ernest Delmonico, owner of Delmonico Hatter in New Haven. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hello. Thank you.
So tell us, what would we see if one of our listeners who's never been there, if they walked in the door of Delmonico Hatter, what would they see?
Well, Delmonico Hatter is in downtown New Haven, as you've said. It's a retail hat store. So what you would see right now would be a display of mostly men's hats. There are a few women's hats, but it's mostly a men's hat store of all sizes, styles, and price range, because when you're selling one item, which our item is hats, you really have to appeal across a very broad range.
How has this particular shop and this particular company survived? I mean, really, we've been through an era in which, you know, hats have struggled, retail businesses have struggled, locally owned retail businesses have struggled. You've got all of those things working against you. How have you stayed in business?
Well, determination, I guess, does it. Don't discourage us now, but we do pay attention to our business. We know our business, and, you know, and we've been there.
So somebody who's 25, 30, 35, 40, who wakes up one day and says, I got to go get a hat. I got to go to Delmonico and get a hat. What's making that happen these days? There's a word we need to say, which is hipster. There are people, a lot of people in Brooklyn walking around in fedoras right now where they wouldn't have been maybe 20 years ago. Is that one of the big drivers? I mean, you've got a big student population there in New Haven.
That certainly is a big driver in parts of Brooklyn. The hipster crowd, and they are wearing fedoras. And we see some of that. Our student population in New Haven is not our customer base. I mean, we sell some, of course, but it's not driving the business stuff. That they're not wearing the same items that are being worn in Brooklyn.
Okay. I teach there, so I can kind of confirm that a little bit. I guess another question that I have is, so there was a time, certainly within my lifetime, when any city you went to would have a store like Delmonico, maybe two or three stores like Delmonico, depending on how big the city was. And certainly I'm from Hartford. Oh, we had a store very much like yours up here for many years. But these stores have, in fact, a lot of lights on those stores have gone out over the years. How unusual is Delmonico at this point? I mean, is it the case that there are only like 20, 25, 30 stores left in the country like you?
There are probably that many, maybe a few more. They're mostly in the larger cities, mm-hmm. Detroit, Chicago, New Orleans. But there are many stores that were founded just about the time we were, in the early part of the 20th century. And some of them are still surviving. Most of them, particularly the ones in the Northeast and what have you, went out of business in the 50s and 60s. The owners retired, and hat wearing was off, and new members of the family certainly weren't going to get into that business.
I want you to tell a story about being in California. We should say that, as has been suggested, there are people all over the country who can get on the Delmonico website. Your hats are sometimes used in the fashion industry, in the film industry, even if those fashion shows or film shoots are located far, far away. But talk about the person you ran into in California who was wearing an interesting hat.
This happens often where we'll be literally walking down the street and see our hat boxes in cities all over the country because we do sell all over the country. I was in the airport, it was just about a year ago now, in San Diego, and I'm just walking through the airport and there was a man sitting over on the side and he had a nice Borsellino hat, an Italian hat, sitting on his luggage. And I just pointed at it and said, nice hat, Borsellino. And he looked up and was starting a conversation. He said, oh, yeah, I have four or five of them just like that. And I said, they're really nice. And I talked to him for a couple of minutes, and I thought, okay, let me find out where he gets these. I said, where do you buy your hats? And he said, oh, I get them from New Haven, from Delmonico. And I said, I'm Delmonico. And he said, oh, you're the best.
Is there in your store kind of the equivalent of a BMW or a Mercedes of hats? What's the high end of hats for you guys?
So we have hats that are under $50, and we have felt hats that go in the $600 range, and then Panama straw hats that go a few hundred dollars beyond that. But the $600 fur felt hat with the one we have, the most popular one we have at that price range is Borsellino also. It's made in Italy. It's 100% beaver fur.
But, you know, if there's a high-end for, say, the straw hat, the Panama hat, is that right. actually coming from Central America or South America somewhere? Is that still where those hats are made?
The bodies are woven in Ecuador, and some hats are actually bought, block, trimmed, and finished there. We have the bodies brought up to the United States and blocked at a couple of locations in the United States, and we also have some that are blocked and finished in Italy. They're called Panama hats. But there's no relation to the Isthmus of Panama other than the fact that, and I don't know which really brought it across is why they're called Panama hats, but the trading went from Ecuador into Panama, and many of them were sold to the miners going from the East Coast out to California during the gold rush days. And so they bought them there and called them Panama hats. There's also a very famous photo of President Roosevelt in the building of the Panama Canal, where he was sitting on a construction equipment and wearing a Panama hat.
Let me ask you one last question here, and this is maybe not an unthinkable possibility. Imagine that I walked into your store, and I said, look, I'm sure you get a few customers like this. Like, I want to get a hat. I feel like I'd like to start wearing a hat sometimes, but I don't really know anything about hats, and I don't know what kind of hat I should get. Would you be likely to say, well, no, don't get that kind of hat. That's not right for you. In other words, would you try to match me up with a hat that either fit my looks or what you took to be my personality? How would you guide me?
Well, the buyer always gives us some guidance. It doesn't really happen they walk in and give us a blank slate like that.
Okay.
They'll tell us that some hat they saw, someone they saw, where they're going to wear it. From that, we'll get an idea of where to go with it. Certainly, we would look at the build of the person. If there's a smaller person, we wouldn't give them a great big wide brim hat. And you would go in that direction. We also have to encourage them as they're buying, if it's a first hat like that, because looking in the mirror and seeing a hat on their head, everything is going to look different for them. We would have to tell them which one really looked good and which one we wouldn't let them go out the door with. we do that, and it works.
I was hoping that you would say that. All right. Well, Ernest Delmonico of Delmonico Hatter in New Haven, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
We wanted to end with some kind of salute to Danbury because it is the Hat City. We wanted to also have some reading of Billy Collins's The Death of the Hat. And so we got a Danbury native poet to close the show for us. His name is Chris Booth, and he is reading Billy Collins's The Death of the Hat. Big thanks to the Connecticut Poetry Society who helped us find Chris. And here it goes, that classic Billy Collins poem, The Death of the Hat.
Once every man wore a hat. In the ashen newsreels, the avenues of cities are broad rivers flowing with hats. The ballparks swelled with thousands of straw hats, brims and bands, rows of men smoking and cheering in shirt sleeves. Hats were the law. They went without saying. You noticed a man without a hat in a crowd. You bought them from Adams or Dobbs, who branded your initials in gold on the inside band. Trolleys crisscrossed the city. Steamships sailed in and out of the harbor. Men with hats gathered on the docks. There was a person to block your hat, and a hat check girl to mind it while you had a drink or ate a steak with peas and a baked potato. In your office stood a hat rack. The day war was declared, everyone in the street was wearing a hat, and they were wearing hats when a ship loaded with men sank in the icy sea. My father wore one to work every day and returned home carrying the evening paper, the winter chill radiating from his overcoat. But today we go bareheaded into the winter streets, stand hatless on frozen platforms. Today, the mailboxes on the roadside and the spruce trees behind the house wear cold white hats of snow. Mice scurry from the stone walls at night in their thin fur hats to eat the birdseed that has spilled. And now my father, after a life of work, wears a hat of earth, and on top of that, a lighter one of cloud and sky, a hat of wind.